Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to share the intensity of travel experiences with readers who may or may not ever visit faraway destinations in person? Born to Indian parents in England and then spending part of his childhood in the United States, Pico Iyer's life has been surrounded by travel for as long as he can remember. His first published writing on the subject came when he was a student at Harvard and signed up to spend summer breaks moving through Europe and writing for the Let's Go series of guidebooks. Since then, Iyer has been all over the world and has won a circle of friends diverse enough to include writer and musician Leonard Cohen and the Dalai Lama. The long list of books by Pico Iyer includes The Global Soul, Sun After Dark, and The Open Road. He's in town to speak tonight at Arts and Letters Live series at the Dallas Museum of Art. Pico, welcome back to Think.
It's really nice to talk to you again.
Do you see the world as really vast or really small?
Vast, actually. And I think we have the illusion that we're more connected than ever before. And that illusion almost makes us more distant from other people. And certainly the world is inexhaustibly interesting. You know, I know a lot of people who say that wherever you go today, when you get off the plane in Jordan or in Shanghai, you see McDonald's and Lady Gaga and Starbucks. And therefore the world is all of a piece. But when they're in those other places, they become something utterly different. So I never find the world as boring or homogeneous.
I think that's one really interesting thing about your writing, by the way, is that some people, when they're writing about places that whatever their audience would consider to be exotic, and of course things are never exotic to the people who live there every day, but a lot of people try to sort of edit out anything that speaks of the encroachment of the modern world or of you know, Western style cultural hegemony, and that those things don't seem to bother you.
No, because I think every culture sings Lady Gaga in its own accent. Mm-hmm. It draws from this common pool of global images, but it makes them entirely its own. So, for example, if I go into a McDonald's in my parents' homeland, India, most of the dishes are vegetarian. It's as chaotic and raucous as the streets outside. People are drinking spiced cardamom tea. There's nothing about it that would correspond to a McDonald's in Dallas. And when I go to a McDonald's in Japan, where I live now, they're eating moon-viewing burgers at the time of the harvest moon. They're dressed in Dior and Gucci. Everything about the way that they're talking or not talking is as Japanese as it ever would be. So it's almost as if we're all speaking the same language, but our accents are still so different and our manners are so different that we might as well be on different planets still.
You have said that it's an advantage in your line of work to feel in some ways like an outsider everywhere that you go. First of all, what does it mean to you to feel like an outsider?
Well, I probably said that because I have to believe that because I've been an outsider my whole life, as you were saying in your introduction. So I was a little Indian boy born in England, and then I was a person with a funny English accent growing up in California, and now I'm a combination of every kind of mutant foreign aspect living in Japan. But I think an outsider can often see and appreciate things that the local takes for granted. My example isn't interesting, but what strikes me about the new century, if I go to a university, say, most of the kids I meet are much more international and multicultural, and to that extent sort of us outsiderly than I am. A typical college student today may have one home associated with her parents and one with her partner and one where she happens to be and another with her dreams, and her whole life will be spent almost putting those together to try to make a new composite whole. And so a part of her is going to be an outsider whichever of those cultures she's going to be in. And it's almost, I've often felt, it's like whether the glass is half empty or half full. You can either say, I don't belong here, so I feel alienated and out of place, or I don't belong here, so I'm thrilled because I have the diplomatic immunity of a foreigner. I can enjoy everything about it without paying the taxes, as it were. So I've chosen that latter response.
Does it make it hard in some ways to relate to people that you are writing about who absolutely feel like part of where they're from?
No, because I think probably I travel in order to learn from and admire those people. And you were saying wonderfully how that we try to filter out things. And when we go to places that are exotic to us, they're not exotic to the people there. What's exotic to them is us. You and I walking down the street, we're the items of curiosity and fascination and tragicomedy. So I always feel that when I go to any place, I'm involved in a kind of exchange of dreams. I'm going for whatever I project onto their culture, which maybe, as you said, ground groundedness and traditionalism and antiquity, and they're fascinated by Dallas or California and all the places that represent the opposite of what they know. And I've always enjoyed that sense of engagement, and precisely the fact that I'm different from them and have perhaps more mobility than many of the people I visit makes them want to partake vicariously of my mobility and find out about the places I visited or the places they dream of where I come from.
You must have a really interesting perspective on what people imagine the United States to be who have never been here.
Yes, partly because I am one such person. I'm an immigrant myself, and I still remember growing up as a little boy in Oxford, England. In the 1960s, the United States was the Beverly Hillbillies and the Dick Van Dyke Show, and a little later, the Grateful Dead. And when my family and I moved to California, of course, we quickly saw that it was and wasn't those things. But I think those of us who live in the U.S., don't often understand quite the allure it has for the rest of the world. But I do, being in part in the rest of the world. For example, I remember when the first McDonald's came to Oxford, England. It was like a liberation, because previously we'd only had very fancy kind of snooty restaurants or very cheap, horrible, fake hamburger restaurants. And suddenly this democratic, reliable, convenient place came into Oxford, and I think it really changed the way that we lived, especially as students. I think the part of the fascination of travel is that everything acquires a different value when it goes abroad. So the very things that we don't think twice about at home become lustrous and glamorous when they're abroad.
Do you ever feel the need to represent any of the places that are at least part of who you are when you travel to other parts of the world?
That's a very good question. And of course, when people ask me, where do you come from, that most essential question, I do change, or I choose my answer according to where I am.
Yeah.
And in many places, I will present myself as an American. I've been spending a lot of time in the Middle East of late. So I've been going to places like Syria and Yemen and Oman and Beirut, and I feel that they have not a very rosy picture of America. So when they ask me, where do you come from, I always say America, partly to remind them that so many Americans are like me, small, dark-skinned, more similar to the Middle Easterners than different.
Yeah.
And also to remind them, I, as a somewhat typical American, am traveling all across the world using a lot of money to learn more about their culture, that Americans aren't antagonistic necessarily towards them, but eager, in my case at least, to make contact with them. Other places which are very hostile to America, I choose to present myself as an Indian because they're fascinated with Mahatma Gandhi or yoga or some such. But it's nice to be able to have the chance to select.
Does that sense of foreignness strike you most when you're in India, in that you didn't spend any extended amount of time there, and yet if someone were to look at you, they might make the assumption that you're Indian?
Absolutely. Yes, so that's the one place I'm embarrassed to be a foreigner, because as you said, I've never lived a day of my life there. I don't speak a word of any of its 200 languages. And it used to be that if somebody came up to me on the streets of Delhi and spoke fluent Hindi and I looked bewildered as if I'd just arrived from the Jetsons planet, I felt embarrassed. Mm-hmm. But now what saves me is that so many Indians are in my category. There are so many Indians who've grown up, for example, in this country who are equally removed, and those people in India now are aware of that. So in that way, the world is becoming more accommodating to those of us who don't fit within the categories.
What languages do you speak?
English, really. Mm-hmm. Growing up in a very traditional England, I had to learn Latin for 8 years and ancient Greek for 8 years and ancient Old English and French and German. But you know, the beauty of speaking English is you're speaking the language everyone else in the world longs to listen to. So if I'm in Bali, say, and I've scrupulously tried to learn 6 words of Bahasa Indonesia, before I can inflict them on the people around me, they're very keen to see me as a walking free English lesson. So the two languages I've had to teach myself a little are Japanese and Spanish. But my Japanese, after many years, is that of a three-year-old female, because I've learned from my Japanese wife.
I have found that when I have traveled to places where I don't speak the local language and they don't necessarily speak much English, I'm always surprised that when I come home, I don't have a lot of memories of having trouble communicating. And I don't know what explains that.
I so agree with you. The most universal language is a smile or a shrug or an extended hand. And I often tell people, and I'm not being perverse, I'm being honest to say that with my Japanese wife, we've been together 23 years, her English is limited, my Japanese is more limited. I have far fewer communication problems than with my neighbors in California. And famously, that's because in California, we do have the illusion of a common language, but those of us who grew up in England are really speaking completely different tongue from a Californian, completely different set of values, whereas those of us who grew up in England share a lot of values with another old culture like Japan. And the Japanese, for example, are very good at speaking without words. They're very good at listening. They're connoisseurs of silence, caretakers of silence in some ways. And so they know exactly how to follow your body language and to read your face so as to know what you're trying to communicate, even if you have no words in common. And I think those are often some of the most rewarding exchanges that we have when we're traveling.
How much inherent difference does culture impose upon people?
I think a lot. And I think it's not to be underestimated. And I think that's, of course, the great challenge in our country, in our cities at the moment. As you probably know, I once spent 2 weeks living in and around Los Angeles Airport. And I was taking the airport to be the model of the city of the future, where people from 150 cultures have assembled under the same roof. They're all sharing the same space, but they're walking and talking past one another, and they're not necessarily sharing the same values. And I think that is the question that's being posed to America in the 21st century, and it's difficult to come up with the right answers, that we have so much in common on the surface, and yet the distances between us are profound.
Is there such a thing that you would consider an archetypal sort of existing city, an archetypal 21st century city?
Well, I'm very optimistic about Toronto. And one of the interesting things is that according to the UN, it's statistically the most multicultural city on the planet. And also famously, statistically, it's the single safest city in North America. And I would say it's got one of the richest cultures. And so if you put those two or three statistics together, you come up with a rather hopeful vision of how many places can come together in a single space, can preserve their original identity, but can also interact and create all kinds of new cultural combinations. So it seems to be working very wonderfully in Toronto. But in many other places like Los Angeles, near which I live, it seems to be dystopia almost. So there's no formula. Of course, Canada has a great advantage over our country that it's so small and so compact and not burdened with some of the responsibilities that we have here.
I was really struck a few months ago. I was watching a documentary with my kids called Babies, and it's essentially about how these five infants are in different parts of the world are raised. And, there are some very stark differences, but then you have an infant from San Francisco and one from Tokyo, and it seems like everything about their existence is identical.
And yet you and I were just talking before we came on air about the response to the earthquake, and everything about that, what we saw in Japan, was, I'd say, the opposite of what we might see in San Francisco.
Calm and sort of acceptance and fortitude.
Yes. And so I've lived in this little household in rural Japan with my wife and her two children, and I've seen those two children go right the way through adolescence. And all the things that we associate with adolescence, shouting at your mom, punching your sister, being in full of turmoil, I've never seen any of that in this household. And it's a very typical one. It's not that it's not going on. It's just that people have been conditioned to be non-confrontational, not to express their anger or their sorrow to those around them, not to impose it on them, and to try to make harmony, at least in the public domain, regardless of what they're feeling privately. And so at least to look at a household like that, it couldn't be further from the ones I'm used to in England or in this country.
Do you try to always stay with people as opposed to staying in hotels when you're in a new place?
No, I actually do stay in hotels usually. And of course, what I and I think most travelers find is you're instantly the most popular person in town. I tend to be a fairly reclusive person, and I'm an only child and I'm used to being by myself. But when I'm traveling, especially if it's in a difficult or an imprisoned country, I quickly have more friends than I know what to do with. I mean, all the people are gathered outside the hotel sometimes wanting to strike up a conversation or a deal or something with you. And of course, that brings its own challenges. But I never feel lonely when I'm traveling. I never feel that I want more company than I have.
Do you think that travel cures loneliness?
I think it's a deceptive cure. It's a Band-Aid over an abyss in some ways. So it's not a real cure because you can be surrounded by a lot of people and you are often a source of fascination and even glamour to them because you're richer or you have the freedom to travel or you're from a powerful country. But they're not really fascinated by you for yourself, but by the illusions that they associate with your culture. And that's often what you're fascinated by in them, too. So I think it can be very dangerous to succumb to that. If I'm walking down the streets of Havana, Cuba, every 5 minutes, a beautiful young woman is going to come and propose marriage to me. And if I get excited about that or respond to that, then I'm really in dire straits because it has nothing to do with who I am or how I look or just the fact she can tell I'm a foreigner and she wants to leave Cuba. And that's a model for what's happening in a lot of places. So I think one has to be wisely disenchanted about some of what goes on there.
My guest is travel writer Pico Iyer. His books include The Global Soul, Sun After Dark, and The Open Road. He's in town to speak to the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live series tonight. You can find information about the event on the Think page of KERA.org. Join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is travel writer Pico Iyer. He's in town to speak to the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live series. The event takes place tonight at the Horchow Auditorium. You can find a link to ticket information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org. You mentioned Cuba before the break, and I know you have a particular affinity for Cuba, and it's a place that I think a lot of Americans are really curious about because, for the most part, we really can't go there.
Yes, and the regulations are always changing. I used to go either through Mexico or through Canada, and of course the Cubans are delighted to see us. And to this day, when my friends say, where in the world should we go on holiday, and I always recommend Cuba first as the most fascinating, complicated, sad, happy, idealistic, cynical place that I've been. And it goes back actually to your first question about the distances between places, because it's only 90 miles away from us, of course. They don't really know very much about us, and we know even less about them. And I remember once I was in Cuba, and what happens is everyone clusters around you. If you're from America, you're instantly the most popular person in town, and they all want you to send letters to their loved ones back here, because there isn't really a postal service between their country and ours. And I remember once somebody asked me, where do you come from? And I said, California. And he said, oh, my brother lives in California, and he's got this huge house and swimming pool and tennis courts. Please, will you send a letter when you get back home to my brother? And I'm really hoping he can rescue me from the difficulty of Havana and take me to California. So I did. And a week later, to my amazement, a letter came back from this brother. And it said, I don't know if you know or if my brother knows my circumstances, but I'm here in San Quentin prison and I'm on death row. And I'm really, really hoping my brother in Havana can do something, anything, to rescue me and get me back to the Cuba that I miss so much. So there you have just two brothers in neighboring countries, essentially. Neither knows the first thing about the other's circumstances, and each is reaching out to get the life that the other has without knowing. And it speaks to me for so much that's going on across the world, that we dream of the other place, and the other place is not just dreaming of us, but in a very different circumstances than we imagine.
What a heartbreaking story.
Yeah, and I think when you travel, that happens a lot, and especially in places like Cuba, it happens a lot, because they're living unimaginably dramatic lives. Most of the people you meet in Havana as a foreigner are, of course, people who want to leave. The people who are content there don't particularly want to fraternize with Americans. And the things that they're trying to do to leave, whether it's to swim across or to take an inner tube or to marry or whatever, sort of humble one with the intensity of that passion.
You've been to very rich countries. You've been to very poor countries. Does the impact of witnessing extreme poverty change over time?
Well, I hope one doesn't get inured to it. I think it really what it does is make me appreciate much more the things I take for granted. When I'm sitting at home in Santa Barbara, I and my neighbors are always complaining about everything that's wrong with our town and with our country. Yeah. And as soon as we go almost anywhere, we realize we are living the lives that people are dreaming of, and that we take for granted freedom and comfort and sufficient food that the majority of our neighbors on the planet probably can't. I remember at the turn of the century when everyone was so excited about the internet, and I tell my friends, two-thirds of the people on the planet have never even used a telephone. Or I sometimes get excited about frequent flyer miles, and then I think 97% of my global neighbors will never even get on a plane. I'm living in an unreal world. And I suppose I travel partly to ground myself and to remind myself what a bubble and what a kind of gated community I live in, being in this country.
I want to talk a little bit about your earliest experiences travel writing. This is when you were a college student. Did you know what you were getting into?
No. And probably I wouldn't have done it if I had. But now I'm so grateful I did do it. So as you mentioned in your introduction, I was writing for the Let's Go books, which in the 1980s were equivalent to Lonely Planet and Rough Guide books. I mean, they were the ones that took young Americans around Europe. But what I didn't realize when I got the job is that I had $2,000, of which maybe $600 I used in the plane fare to get over to Europe. And I had to travel for 70 days on $1,400, so literally $20 a day. So I had to live the life that my readers were living too, sleeping in gutters, barely eating, going, and even more dramatically, traveling, say, 27 towns in 28 days, I remember, as I had to do in France. So it turned out to be a very good training for what I did later. But at the time, it was a rigorous, unrelenting summer job.
What did you learn about note-taking and about recording your experiences along the way?
Well, I always take many, many more notes than I need because I don't have the luxury of being able to go to those places. Mm-hmm. And I scribble them down in an illegible hand that even I can't read. And sometimes I misread my own handwriting and come up with wonderful word choices. But I did learn then to annotate everything then and there while it's all around you and while you can smell and taste and feel it, because it vanishes as quickly as a dream. And if you leave it even until the next day, the immediacy of any experience has faded. And those, of course, were pre-internet days. So I was obliged every morning when I arrived in a new town to walk around it for maybe 10 hours, see all its ostensible sights, to visit all its cheap hotels, go to all its cheap restaurants, and then retire to the gutter where I was sleeping to write it all up, maybe 10 pages, on carbon paper, and then every 3 weeks I would mail that carbon paper back to Cambridge, Massachusetts, which just shows how far we've come technologically. But it was also a training in writing a lot then and there. And so when maybe 5 years later I began traveling on my own account and wanting to record places, I suddenly realized, oh, well, thank heavens for that training.
It does seem like travel, I mean, it's amazing at any age, but for young people, it is such, you know, suddenly you understand global affairs in a way that you never would, no matter how many newspapers you read or reports you see on the internet. What do you say to young people who might be starting out in their lives and have, you know, 2 weeks a year just of time off work? Is there a way to sort of structure one's plans for travel?
Well, it's interesting you say that because I'm about to give a commencement address next mm-hmm. month for the first time. And I'm going to tell most of those young people, please try to take 2 years off rather than 2 weeks. Because, as you say, you're soon enough going to be tethered 50 weeks of the year to a desk or a family or a career. But take some time off while you're young, while you're reckless, while you're not even conscious of some of the dangers of the world and you're not always looking over your shoulder. And then whatever you return to, whether it's graduate school or a job or marriage, you'll be much, much more motivated. And I must say, I'm also going to tell them that they're sitting on this wonderful opportunity that wasn't even available when I was growing up, but which wasn't such a long time ago, the 1970s. There were no student abroad programs. No young person I'd ever met had been to Buenos Aires or Prague or Cape Town or Bangkok, the places lots of kids are now. When I was in high school, there were 1,250 boys in the school, zero girls, and 1,240 boys were from the same race, same religion, and same social class. And now you wouldn't find that. And so I would say to young people, you're growing up already with the advantage of a much more diverse world around you and a much more mobile world. So please do what your grandparents or even your parents could never dream of doing and make your destiny global. And what thrills me is so many of them are doing that. They don't need me to say it because they're already, from a very young age, often as a result of a student abroad or a vacation they took when they were 19 or 21, they're already committing themselves to Cambodia or Bolivia or interesting places that will change them and that whose riches they'll bring back to our country.
How do you decide your next destination?
My intuition, really. It's almost like if you're in a party and there's somebody who compels you for some reason that you don't understand and never will be able to explain to yourself. I have a great advantage because I'm not one of the people who only has 2 weeks a year of holiday. And if I were, and if I were stuck to a desk, then I would use my 2 weeks for Hawaii or Venice or somewhere beautiful and comforting. But because I can more or less make my own schedule, I often choose unbeautiful, uncomforting places, discomforting places. And I feel that I'm living in California and Japan, which are both very easy, protected places. So when I travel, I try to go to places as far from my experience as possible, to Yemen or Ethiopia or North Korea, because I think they're the ones that are going to most stretch and educate and deepen me.
Is there a different experience in the places that are considered mundane by the locals than there is in the historic sites or maybe the great cities? You know, like Indianapolis as opposed to New York City, but in any country in the world.
Well, I went for the first time to Little Rock last year, and I was transported. I'm about to go back. I really was interested in it. And of course, a lot of this has to do with expectation. I knew nothing about Little Rock before. I'd barely seen it presented in movies or music. And so everything was disarming to me and very involving. Whereas New York City comes with so many screens because we all imagine that we do know it. But I suppose my criterion really to go back to your first question is to think what my life is like now and then turn it on its head. And that is the place that that I want to seek out, or a place that has never begun to come into my history. So I grew up in Europe surrounded by 13th century cathedrals and cloisters, and so that doesn't have much appeal to me. Whereas to go to a place like Dubai, where I was recently, I thought, well, that's interesting. It's not a pleasant or an attractive place, but it's part of the new century, and it's something that I want to learn about, because otherwise it'll hit me on the head before I know what's going on.
Dubai is an interesting country to talk about, or place to talk about. What have you observed in terms of the different ways that people look at money and how it should be used and how it should be displayed or sort of concealed?
Yes. Well, and of course, Dubai is the world cathedral of conspicuous consumption. Makes Beverly Hills look understated, or Las Vegas look backward by comparison. So, but I can understand a place that has suddenly got very rich is going to strut its stuff and invest in mango-colored Lamborghinis and Armani hotels, as I saw there. But it's interesting because just before I was in Dubai, I was in its neighboring country, Oman, which has a very wise sultan. And he's seen everything that's been going on around him in Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, and decided he wants something much more tasteful and quiet and traditional. So what he's done is greatly improve with his oil money the hospitals and schools and the facilities of his people. But he's also mandated, rather like in Bhutan, that everybody live in traditional style houses. They all wear traditional clothes. And there's something very tasteful and elegant and dignified about Oman by comparison with Dubai. So they both have the same amount of money, but I think the Sultan of Oman seems to be saying that he should use it for charitable purposes rather than for showy ones, and that the traditions are the source of the wealth as much as the oil money. And he says to his people, well, the oil will probably run out in 30 years, so what are we going to do then? The important thing is education and to lay the foundations for success even when we don't have the oil coming in.
It's always so fascinating. It's interesting that you also mentioned Bhutan. When you hear about a place where there is a wise monarch who decides to cede some power and turn things over for the future of things, and you've been to Bhutan, is that right?
I have, yes.
Can you talk about, it's not so isolated in that no one's allowed to go, but for a long time they really limited travel through there.
Yes, very, very limited. And that's one of those places where when they asked where I came from, I suddenly said India, because there's a little loophole whereby people with Indian passports are allowed to go for no money at all and stay for as long as they like.
And they do pilgrimages and that sort of thing?
Yes, or in my case, just go and take over a hotel that every tourist would have to spend $200 a day for and spend $5 a day there and just be by myself and float invisibly through the country, which is what I did. But it is an interesting example of somewhere that's very protected. I was just talking to a mountain climber back in California, and he was frustrated because you're not allowed to climb mountains in Bhutan. It's part of the preservation. And of course, they've instituted the global notion now of great gross national happiness, which slowly the rest of the world is waking up to, that money isn't the most important counter for contentment or for richness even. So it's an interesting model, though, because it is so protected. When I went to Bhutan, I felt that Nepal, which is flooded with tourists, is actually more interesting. Bhutan was almost too quiet for me and too pristine. And there's an excitement that comes out of the encounter between cultures that I like and, of course, couldn't find in Bhutan.
When you talk about cultures mixing, there's been so much hand-wringing, rightfully so, about American cultural hegemony. Do you think that we've absorbed as much global culture as we have exported to the rest of the world?
I do. And I think when we worry that Nepal or China or India is going to lose its soul to Americanized things, I think we're underestimating them, that most of those countries have been around 3,000 years. They know exactly how to take what they like about America without being transformed within, just the way that we in Dallas or California will probably this afternoon get into our Japanese cars, drive to the Thai restaurant, go from there to yoga, and then maybe do salsa dancing. But we're just as American as we always were. And if that's true of us, it's many times more so of the older cultures in the world. So I think it's great that everyone can learn from and enjoy the fruits of every other culture.
Do you think when you're writing for your audience, is there any danger that we will read your work and maybe feel like, well, now I know, I've read Pico Iyer's work, and clearly many people are inspired to actually go, but some people will think, well, I know this place now. I know Cuba because I have read your book.
I really hope they don't think that, because for one thing, I'm in a position of absolute ignorance. In most of the countries I visit, I've never studied. I don't speak the language. I'm only there very briefly. And all that I can hope to offer is a typical everyman's, tourist's response to it. But so my hope is, just as you said, that I will quicken the interest of people to go and see see themselves. Nowadays, I think the bigger danger is that sitting at home, you can access Cuba on the internet and see programs about it on TV, and they bring the culture home to you with much more vibrancy than my prose does. And after you've gone through every nook of the Potala Palace in Tibet online, you may think there's no reason to go. But I think actually there's a greater need than ever to go and not get the mediated screened experience, but to get the human one-on-one encounter.
What are the challenges for you when you're writing for something like a magazine and you're working with a photographer who will document things that you may not cover and vice versa?
Well, the great trick there is to try to go before the photographer, and then he has to photograph
so you
wrote.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I do have the challenge often that many a travel magazine will say that the places I want to go to, let's say Ethiopia or Yemen or whatever, are not very photogenic. And so I will usually have to find a way to present, to point out why they're important for us to know about and for us to visit. And my other dirty secret, I suppose, is that often when I am sent a place by a magazine, I'll write one piece for the magazine and another piece for myself. Mm-hmm. Because I know in a magazine context, you have certain constraints and you are writing for a reader to introduce him or her to that place. But when you're engaged in the culture by yourself, you're having many more things that are private experiences, perhaps that aren't interesting to a magazine reader, but life-changing for you. And so I try and keep almost parallel accounts, one public and one private.
So how do those accounts differ? I mean, are there things that you think, this really changed me, but I don't want to share that with everybody else?
Or that I shouldn't share it. That nobody wants to read about my love affair in Japan, say, or with Japan, when they're planning a holiday in Kyoto. What mm-hmm. they want to know is where to see and what to eat and how to navigate this very, very foreign place. So I reserve the private stuff for my books. So it's not so private.
Yeah.
It's just that the expectations a reader brings to a book are very different from the ones she brings to a magazine. And nowadays, in the magazine, the dread phrase is takeaway, that you want something tangible that you've learned from it. Whereas in a book, you're surrendering to an intimate conversation that'll last for 6 hours, and there you're ready to hear about somebody's love affair the way you are if you're spending a long evening in a bar with somebody and they're telling you their life-changing experiences.
So do the magazine articles pay the bills and the books feed your soul?
Exactly. Perfectly put.
My guest this hour is travel writer Pico Iyer. His books do include The Global Soul, Sun After Dark, and The Open Road. He's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live Series. You can find a link to ticket information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is travel writer Pico Iyer. He's in town to speak tonight at the Horchow Auditorium of the Dallas Museum of Art to the Arts and Letters Live Series. You can find a link to ticket information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@KERA.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. And right now on the line, we have Shanaz in Mesquite. Hi, Shanaz.
Hi. Just wanted to ask a question for Mr. Pico.
Mm-hmm.
I have read his articles in Condé Nast magazines, and I wanted to ask him which 5 countries, if he can, have fascinated him the most, either scenic-wise or culture-wise, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. What a wonderful question. I think I mentioned Cuba before, and part of the excitement of that is everything is happening at top volume out in the street, round the clock. So when you're walking down the street, as soon as you arrive, somebody is trying to sell you a turtle and somebody's asking you to marry her and somebody's asking you for a job with the CIA and somebody else is inviting you a job with the Cuban CIA. I think Ethiopia is one of the most stirring, intense places I've ever visited, and there's a sense of devotion and continuity. They've got 1,600 years of unbroken Christianity there, unique in the world, that I have rarely seen elsewhere. The place that's similar to Ethiopia is Tibet, and that is the only place where I really feel as if I've been lifted out of the world I know and lifted out of the self I know and almost taken to the rooftops of my being. And just the sense of those intense cobalt skies and the shafts of sunlight coming into the dusty rooms where monks are rocking back and forth over their sutras in the corner. It's a very transporting place, even in the midst of its current political difficulties and suffering. My own favorite country, which I think does suffer from not very good PR and disarms people by being so kind and passionate and interesting, is Japan. And even if you don't like Japan, I recommend you go there because it's more like another planet than anywhere else on Earth. And I say that even after living there for 24 years. So it's like going to Pluto or Mars, I would say. So that's four, I think. And maybe the fifth that I would choose in the Americas, apart from Cuba, would be Bolivia, because it's the most indigenous, unspoilt place in South America than I'm aware of. And you're stepping into the 14th century, which sometimes makes for difficulties because a lot of things go wrong. And I almost died in a car crash on my last trip there. But it's a very, very rich and uncontaminated culture there. So those are five. But I must say, I so enjoy traveling, I could probably offer 55.
Have you ever been to North Korea?
I have. And it's probably the scariest place I've ever been, excuse me, because it's the one furthest from every notion that we have. What is reality? What is humanity? What is life? Doesn't translate there. So I remember when I was there, they were building the largest tourist hotel in the world, 101 stories high, for a country, of course, that doesn't allow tourists. They were building huge Olympic stadiums, but they will never hold the Olympic Games. Every morning at 6 in the morning along the main boulevards, they have loudspeakers broadcasting propaganda saying, our leader is the greatest man on earth and we live in a socialist paradise. When you turn on the TV in your hotel room, out comes, our leader is the greatest man on earth and we are living in a socialized paradise. I've never been to a place that's so entirely sealed. And I've always thought, and we've been saying this entire hour, that as soon as you meet a place, you can't demonize it anymore. It has a human face and a soul to you. But a place like North Korea is profoundly dangerous to us because they've never seen us, and we're just an abstraction. And so it was an unsettling but interesting place to go. And it's the least interesting place to go to in one respect, which is it looks identical to a photograph. And so if you've seen pictures of North Korea, in some ways you've been there. At least the parts that they show foreigners are like advertisements in a magazine, spotless and almost humanless.
Are you sort of with a handler the entire time that you're there?
Yes. The North Korean government very thoughtfully gave me a handler who spoke Urdu, the language of Islamic India and Pakistan. Unfortunately, I don't speak a word of it. His expertise was wasted on me. But it was really interesting because we did indeed spend 72 hours together. He was rarely more than 5 feet away from me. And he'd lived for 3 years in Pakistan, so he did know what the rest of the world looked like. And I remember on the last day, he took me up to a hill and we looked out over this beautiful, spotless city of gleaming skyscrapers and empty streets that looked like Manhattan if it had been stripped of all its people. And he said, just look at this. We built it all up in the rubble of the Korean War. If you look at this, how can you not say we're the most impressive country on earth? This is what we've achieved in 40 years. And he also told me, which made an impression, please don't spread my North Korean propaganda when you go back to the U.S. and talk to your friends. Just tell them what you saw here. And he was sufficiently convinced that what I'd seen would make me a believer, too.
That is shocking and sad. And did you want to sort of shake him by the shoulders and say, it's just you and me, and you must know there's more out there?
I think he was speaking from the heart because, as you say, he did know that there was more out there. And it was one of those things that reminded me of how provincial I am. So by my criteria, I would never want to live in this completely planned Orwellian dystopia, as it seems. But he would probably never want to live in the chaos of New York City or East Los Angeles. And within his terms, he was living in the best place on earth. And I love the fact that travel is constantly reminding us how partial our perspective is and how if you just see things from another angle, another place is really beautiful in its own way.
If you're going to read someone else's account of a place that you've come to know fairly well and really care about, do you want to read that before you go, or do you prefer to have drawn your own impression first and then compared what you think with what other people think?
If I'm writing about it, I'd like to keep my mind clear and not have those responses to play off against. I was just writing to a friend this morning. I'm very excited to see the new movie, Tree of Life, by mm-hmm. the Texan Terrence Malick, and I'm making sure not to read any reviews. If I'm not going to write about a place and I want to learn about it, then I will read Jan Morris or one of the great travel writers in advance, just to have some sense of what I'm going into. And I will nearly always plan my trip in advance using a Lonely Planet book, knowing that as soon as I arrive on the tarmac of the foreign airport, all the plans will fly out of the window. But the plans give me the illusion that I know where I'm going, which helps me to go somewhere completely different often.
Have you developed a special way of coping with the frustrations of just the travel portion of travel? Airports and that sort of thing?
Probably no special way. I always have a book. Mm-hmm. I always assume that things are going to go wrong, and I'm happy if they don't. I fit the profile of a terrorist to perfection. So I've been strip searched for 20 or more years wherever I go, so I'm not fazed by that. But I do think that travel, as everything, but in a more dramatic way, is just a function of what we bring to it. And it's almost, you can choose beforehand whether you're going to be aggravated or not. And I always think that when I'm at home, there's plenty that can aggravate me as my editors are sending me messages and the phone lines are going down and whatever. But I'm traveling in order to be transported and to be taken to parts of myself I wouldn't ordinarily see. So I think travel is an instruction in patience. And I like the fact that you're obliged to be patient while you're traveling, or else you're going to be in a permanent state of volcanic agitation.
You do it to yourself, essentially.
I probably tell myself that's one reason I'm traveling.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Joan in Dallas. Hey, Joan.
Hey. I'm glad you mentioned Cuba, because that's somewhere I've always wanted to go. And I've always read that you make instant friends if you can. Of course, I don't know if you can do this in the era of 9/11 and all the controls we have, but that if you take car parts, like points and plugs and things like that, because they all drive cars from the 50s, and so they can't get those parts. You know if that's true?
I think that makes absolute sense, because all those cars from the 50s are still juddering through the streets of Havana. But if you can't take those, and you're right, there may be security reasons why you can't, take shampoo or soap or the simplest household items. Toothpaste are very, very difficult to get there. And I found, just as you said, it's easy to make friends there, and the smallest thing goes a very long way, and people are poignantly grateful for you're just taking some Colgate toothpaste, because it involves 6 hours of lines and all kinds of paperwork for them just to get the basic stuff of life.
Are you now, Pico, or have you ever been a collector of souvenirs?
No. I had the experience, I suppose when I traveled in my 20s, I was a little bit. And then my house in California burnt down and I lost everything in it and everything I had in the world. And so since then, I've been less acquisitive and I haven't taken so many photos. And when my house did burn down and I literally had nothing but the toothbrush I bought in an all-night supermarket, one thing that really helped me was all the places I'd seen where people still had even less than I did. Mm. And so I didn't feel sorry for myself, because the insurance allowed me to make a new house, and I still had a much easier life than most people. But I like the question you were asking before also about the aggravations of travel. And I was remembering that last time I flew back to Japan in January, I got to San Francisco for my flight, and it was canceled because of fog, and suddenly I had 24 hours extra in San Francisco. And so I stayed in an airport hotel, and I walked around an area of San Francisco I never would have seen otherwise. And I've lived in California 40 years, and it was as marvelous to me as Japan would have been. And suddenly I had 24 hours free to read a book, to watch the Golden Globes on TV, to walk around this lovely lake 5 miles from San Francisco Airport. And I think the beauty of travel is, even especially maybe when things go wrong, that propels you into situations that you never would have had otherwise.
It must be really amazing. First of all, I would imagine, given your line of work and the fact that you haven't sort of sat behind a desk to work for decades, you have an interesting relationship to time. And then every culture you enter into has to have a different idea of what in a little while means, or what a long time means, or how long a conversation with a stranger ought to last.
Yes, that's wonderfully said. And I live most of my life in Japan, as we were saying, where the 9:16 train always arrives at 9:16, stops for 20 seconds to let everybody out and then it's gone. And so when I travel to a place like India, where the 9:16 train will probably come next year if it comes at all, I hear myself sounding like a Japanese initially. Mm-hmm. Oh, why isn't it here? What's going wrong? And then I have to learn to be an Indian, and I have to learn to adapt to an utterly different way of doing things that India is perfectly comfortable. So it takes often a few days or even a few weeks to do that, but it's always the right thing to do. And after 3 weeks in India, I never want to see the 9:16 train again. I've settled into the Indian rhythm, and I'm happy just to improvise my days.
And common courtesies, are they the same? You know, you have to adjust to what people expect of you.
I suppose you do, in terms of taking photographs of people or which part of the body you show them. You know, you shouldn't point your feet towards people in certain cultures, and you shouldn't shake the hand in Japan, say. So I think guidebooks are helpful in guiding you through some of the ABCs of that. But at the same time, the people one visits are very understanding, I find. They make allowances for tourists. It took me a while in Japan to realize that as I was glumping around the country wearing the bathroom slippers in the streets and doing everything wrong, that in some ways that's almost what they wanted. The foreigner's job in Japan is to play the fool.
Didn't your wife tell you? Honey, don't wear those now.
We weren't married then, but she tells me plenty right now. But nonetheless, I'm still doing things wrong, but not least by speaking a female Japanese, because they have different languages for men and women, and I've picked my Japanese up from my wife, and so if I talk Japanese, they'll fall around laughing, because it's women have different words for I even, and I use those. But actually, that's what the best thing that I can give them. I think what they're more unnerved by in Japan is a foreigner who speaks perfect Japanese to the point that he's penetrated the culture. But I play the foreigner ideally, as far as they're concerned, because I'm doing everything wrong, and that's the role that the foreigner has in the pageant that is Japanese life.
Are you a very adventurous eater?
The opposite, I'm afraid.
Really?
Hence all my references to McDonald's earlier in our conversation. My friends despair of me, and I live in Japan, and most of my friends love Japanese food. And when I'm in Japan, well, I do eat at KFC and McDonald's, but I also eat French food and Italian food and Indian food, which they make very well. But I grew up in England, so my taste buds were surgically extracted in birth, and I have no taste.
Meat and potatoes.
At best, boiled cabbage mostly. So I don't have any sense for food. And instead of spending time, as many of my friends wisely do, with 3-hour meals, great meals, and drinking fine wines, I'm a gourmet of experience. So I just walk and walk and walk the streets, and food barely plays a part in my scheduling.
You're in your 50s now, is that correct?
I am now, yes.
Is there anything that you have gone back to that you think this is not simply because the country has changed, but because you have changed, that it's been an entirely different experience than some place you might have gone 25 years ago?
I think every place is different for those reasons. And I've got to the stage where I much prefer visiting old friends than trying to collect new ones. I often reread some of my favorite books instead of trying to find the latest. And I'm the same with places. So it's more interesting for me to go back to a place now than to find the latest new place that I haven't seen. Because, as you say, it's a register of how I have changed, of how much better perhaps I can understand it now than I did when I was 18 years old, and indeed of how much it has changed. And it's like resuming a conversation with an old friend, which to me is actually more sustaining and fulfilling than just making small talk with somebody you've just met. So I mean, a place like Thailand, I've been back to probably 50 times. I've been to Cuba 6 times, and it's a way of registering who you were in earlier stages of one's life. So I'm often bewildered by the things that I was so fascinated by when I was 23, but that's a good lesson too. And if at home, I would have the same evidence around me, but I might never actually see it.
The long list of books by Pico Iyer includes The Global Soul, Sun After Dark, and The Open Road. He'll speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. Pico, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.